الحمد لله نستعينه ونستهديه ونستغفره ونتوب إليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهديه الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلن تجد له وليا مرشدا. وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. أما بعد، فإن أفضل الكلام كلام الله، وخير الهدي هدي محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم، وشر الأمور محدثاتها، وكل محدثة بدعة، وكل بدعة ضلالة، وكل ضلالة في النار. Dear brothers and sisters, I want to talk to you today about a beautiful article that was written by Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad. He wrote that a long time ago, after the 9/11 events, but well before what happened in London. But I feel that a lot of the parts in this article are as relevant today as they were at the time he wrote it. It's a long article, so I'll just quote some parts of it. Sheikh Murad starts his article by quoting Shakespeare, where he says, "Blood is not an argument." However, Muslim ranks are today swollen with those who disagree. To protest with Washington's acquisition and Israeli policies of ethnic cleansing is the inevitable generator of such hate. It is of course true that the powerlessness can corrupt as intensely as power does. But to comprehend is not to sanction or even to emphasize. To take innocent life to achieve a goal is the hallmark of the most extreme secular utilitarian ethic and stands at the opposite pole of the absolute moral constraints required by religion. The extreme has broadened and the middle ground giving way is everywhere dislocated and confused. And this enfeeblement of the middle ground was what was enjoined by the prophetic example, is in turn accelerated by the opprobrium which the extremists bring not simply upon themselves, but upon committed Muslims everywhere. For here, as elsewhere, the preference of the media work against us. Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad quotes that when David Koresh could broadcast his fringe biblical message from the ranch of Apocalypse without the image of Christianity or even its Adventist wing being in any way besmirched, but when a fringe of Islamic group bombs Swedish tourists in Cairo, the muck is instantly spread over the militant Muslims everywhere. If these things go on, the Islamic movement will cease to form an authentic summons to culture and spiritual renewal. It is in this context, perhaps, that we must present our case for the revival of the spiritual life within Islam. If it is ever to prosper, the Islamic revival must be made to see that it is in a crisis and that its mental resources are proving insufficient to meet contemporary needs. The response to this must be grounded in an act of collective muhasaba, that is self-examination. in terms that transcend the ideological neo-Islam of the revivalists and return to a more classic and indigenously Muslim dialect. It is true that we frequently hear the Quranic verse which states that God does not change the condition of people until they change the condition of their own selves. لا يغير الله ما بقوم حتى يغيروا ما بأنفسهم. But never, it seems, is this principle intelligently grasped. It is assumed that the sacred text is here doing no more than to enjoin individual moral reform as a precondition for collective social success. The verse is speaking of a spiritual change, specifically a transformation of the nafs of the believers, not a moral one. And as the Blessed Prophet never tired of reminding us, there is little value in outward conformity to the rules unless this conformity is mirrored and engendered by an authentically righteous disposition of the heart. No one shall enter the garden by his work, as he expressed it. Meanwhile, the profoundly judgmental and works-oriented tenor of modern revivalists of Islam, fixated on visible manifestations of morality, has failed to address the underlying question of what revelation is for. For it is theological nonsense to suggest that God's final concern is with our ability to conform to a complex of set rules. His concern is rather that we should be restored through our labors and His grace to the state of purity and equilibrium which we were born. The rules are a vital means to that end and are facilitated by it, but they do not take its place. To make this point, the Holy Quran deploys a striking metaphor in Surah Ibrahim, verses 24 to 26. We read, "Have you not seen how God appointed a likeness? A goodly word like a goodly tree, the roots whereof is set firm, its branches in the heaven. It bringeth forth its fruits at every time, by the leave of its Lord. Thus doth good coin likeness for men, that perhaps they may reflect. And the likeness of an evil word is that of an evil tree, that hath been torn up by the roots from upon the earth, possessed of no stability." According to the scholars, the reference here is to the words kalima, of faith, and unfaith. The former is illustrated as a natural growth, whose fluorescence of moral and intellectual achievement is nourished by firm roots, which in turn denotes the basis of faith. The quality of the proofs, one has received, and the certainty and sound awareness of God, which alone signify that one is firmly grounded in the reality of existence. The fruits thus yielded, the palpable benefits of the religious life, are permanent and are not man's own accomplishments, for they only come by the leaves of its Lord. Thus is the sound life of faith. The contrast is then drawn with the only alternative, which is kufr, non-belief, which is not grounded in reality, but in illusion, and is hence possessed of no stability. This passage, reminiscent of some of the binary categorizations of human types presented early on in Surah Al-Baqarah, precisely encapsulates the relationship between faith and works, the hierarchy which exists between them, and the sustainable balance between nourishment and fructition, between taking and giving, which faith must maintain. It is against this criterion that we must judge the quality of contemporary activist style of faith. Is the young ultra, with his intense rage, which can sometimes render him liable to nervous disorders, and his fixation on a relatively narrow range of issues and concerns, really firmly rooted? In the sense of this, in the sense described in the Quran by this image. Sheikh Murad tried to answer this question by giving an example of his own personal experience. Sheikh Al-Hakim Murad says, "I used to know quite well a leader of a radical Islamic group, Jama'a Islamiyya, at the Egyptian University of Asyut. His name was Hamdi. He grew a luxuriant beard, was constantly scrubbing his teeth with a miswak, and spent his time preaching hatred of the Coptic Christians, a number of whom were actually attacked and beaten up as a result of his khutbahs. He had hundreds of followers. The moral of the story is that some 5 years after this acquaintance, Providence again brought me face to face with Sheikh Hamdi." That is, again, Sheikh Murad speaking that he met Sheikh Hamdi 5 years later. He says that this time, chancing to see him on a Cairo street, I almost failed to recognize him. The beard was gone. He was in trousers and a sweater. More astonishing still, that he was walking with a young Western girl who turned out to be an Australian, whom, as he sheepishly explained to me, that's to Sheikh Murad, he was intending to marry. Sheikh Murad spoke to him, and he says, it became clear that he was no longer even a minimally observant Muslim, no longer prayed, and that his ambition in life was to leave Egypt, live in Australia, and make money. What was extraordinary was that his experience in Islamic activism had made no impression on him. He was once again the same distracted, ornery Egyptian youth he had been before his conversion to radical Islam. This phenomenon, which we might label Salafi burnout, is a recognized feature of many modern Muslim cultures. An initial enthusiasm, gained usually in one's early 20s, loses steam some 7 to 10 years later. Prison and torture, the frequent lot of the Islamic radical, may serve to prolong commitment, but ultimately, a majority of these new Muslim relapse, seemingly no better or worse for their experience in the cult-like universe of Salafi midst. This extremist activism should be as suspicious as its content. Authentic Muslim faith is simply not supposed to be this fragile. As the Quran says, its root is meant to be set firm. One has to conclude that of the two trees depicted in the Quranic image, Salafi extremism resembles the second rather than the first. After all, the Sahaba were not known for a transient commitment. Their devotion and piety remained incomparably pure until they died. I hope ours does the same. أَقُولُ قَوْلِ هَذَا وَأَسْتَغْفِرُ اللَّهَ لِي وَلَكُمْ. الحمد لله رب العالمين والعاقبة للمتقين ولا عدوان إلا على الظالمين وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن سيدنا محمد عبده ورسوله، النعمة المهداة والرحمة المزداة والسراج المنير. أما بعد، in the second part of my khutbah, I will address the issue of how we should respond to this disorder. Again, quoting Sheikh Murad from his lovely article. We must begin by remembering that what Islam is for. As we noted earlier, our deen, our Islam, is not ultimately a manual of rules which, when meticulously followed, becomes a passport to paradise. Instead, it is a package of social, intellectual, and spiritual technology whose purpose is to cleanse the human heart. In the Quran, Allah says that on the day of judgment, nothing will be of any use to us except a sound heart, al-qalb al-salim. And in a famous hadith, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, says that, verily, in the body there is a piece of flesh. If it is sound, the body is all sound. If it is corrupt, the body is all corrupt. Verily, it is the heart. إِنَّ فِي الْجَسَدِ لَمُضْغَةٍ إِنْ فَسَدَتْ فَسَدَ الْجَسَدْ كُلُّ وَإِنْ صَلُحَتْ صَلُحَ الْجَسَدْ كُلُّ أَلَا إِنَّ هَذِهِ الْمُضْغَةِ هِيَ الْقَلْبُ. Now, this leads us into the often misunderstood area of Sunnah and Bid'ah. Two notions which are wielded as blunt instruments by many contemporary activists, but which are often grossly misunderstood. The classic Orientalist thesis is, of course, that Islam and the arithmetic is an arithmetic religion, failed to incorporate mechanisms for its own development, and it is petrified upon the death of its founder. This, however, is a nonsense rooted in the ethnic determination of the 19th century historians who had shaped the views of early Orientalists, such as Muir, Le Bon, Renan, and Catini. Islam, as a religion designed for the end of time, has in fact proved itself eminently adaptable to the rapidly changing conditions which characterizes the final and most entropic stage of history. So, what is a bid'ah? According to the classical definition of Islamic law, we all know the famous hadith, "Beware of matters newly begun, for every matter newly begun is an innovation, every innovation is a misguidance, and every misguidance is in hell." That is what I started my khutbah with. فَكُلُّ بِدْعَةٍ ضَلَالَةٍ وَكُلُّ ضَلَالَةٍ فِي النَّارِ. However, we need to understand what is a bid'ah. Does it mean that everything introduced into Islam that was not known to the first generation of Muslims is to be rejected? The classic ulama do not accept such a literalistic interpretation. So let us take the definition of Imam al-Shafi'i, who we all know, of course, is a great authority and is universally accepted by all Muslims. Imam al-Shafi'i writes, I'm quoting here Imam al-Shafi'i's writing, "There are two kinds of introduced matters, muhdathat. One is that which contradicts a text of the Quran or the Sunnah or a report from the early Muslims, the athar, or the consensus, the ijma' of the Muslims. This is an innovation of misguidance. Bid'at dalala. The second kind is that which is in itself good and entails no contradiction of any of these authorities. This is a non-reprehensible innovation. Bid'at ghayru madmuma." This basic distinction between acceptable and unacceptable forms of bid'ah recognized by the overwhelming majority of classic ulama. Among some, for instance, is Al-Izz ibn Abdul Salam. He's one of a half dozen or so great mujtahideen in Islamic history. Innovations fall under five headings of the Sharia. Al-Wajib, which is the obligatory. Al-Mandub, which is the recommended. Al-Mubah, which is the permissible. Al-Makruh, which is the offensive. Wal-Haram, which is the forbidden. So we need to understand these five categories. For example, under the category of obligatory innovation, Ibn Abdul Salam gives the following example recording the Quran and the laws of Islam in writing at a time when it was feared that they would be lost, studying Arabic grammar in order to resolve controversies over the Quran, and developing philosophical theology, al-mukalam, to refute the claims of al-Mu'tazila. All these things he has quoted as examples. Category 2, that is the recommended innovation. Under this heading, they list such activities such as building madaris, schools, writing books on beneficial Islamic subjects, and in-depth studies of Arabic linguistics. All these are bid'ah, but they are recommended bid'ah, recommended innovations. Category 3 is the permissible or neutral innovation, such as worldly activities such as sifting flour and constructing houses in various styles not known in Medina. Now all these are bid'ah as well, but they are neutral bid'ah. They are allowable. Category 4 is the reprehensible innovation. This includes such actions such as over-decorating mosques or over-decorating the Quran. These are bid'ah, and these are reprehensible, but they are not haram. Category 5 is the forbidden innovations. This includes unlawful taxes, giving judgeship to those unqualified to hold them, and sectarian beliefs and practice that explicitly contravene the known principles of the Quran and the Sunnah. Now, the above classification of bid'ah types is normal in classical Sharia literature, being accepted by the four schools of fiqh. There have been only two significant exceptions of this understanding in the history of Islamic thought. The Zahiri school, as articulated by Ibn Hazm, and one wing of the Hanabali madhab. However, this is too complicated, we don't need to go down this way. The important thing is, why is it then that so many Muslims in this day and age believe that innovation in any form is unacceptable in Islam? One factor has already been touched on, that's the mental complexes thrown up by the insecurity, which incline people to find comfort in absolutist and literalist interpretation. Another lies in the influence of the well-financed new Hanabali madhab of Wahhabism, whose leaders are famous for the rejection of all possibility of development. In any case, armed with this more sophisticated and classical awareness of Islam's ability to acknowledge and assimilate novelty, we can understand how Muslim civilization was able so quickly to produce novel academic disciplines to deal with the new problems as they arose. Now, I will stop here because we're running out of time. However, it's a very interesting article, and if anybody would like to refer to it, it is by Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, and the title is The Poverty of Fanaticism. اللهم صل على اللهم اهدنا فيمن هديت وعافنا فيمن عافيت وتولنا فيمن توليت وبارك اللهم لنا فيما اعطيت وقنا واصرف عنا برحمتك شر ما قضيت اللهم ارحمنا بترك المعاصي ابدا ما احييتنا وارحمنا بترك ما لا يعنينا وارزقنا حسن النظر فيما يرضيك عنا والزم قلوبنا حفظ كتابك كما علمتنا واشرح به صدورنا ونور به قلوبنا واطلق به السنتنا اللهم اجعل جمعنا هذا جمعا مرحوما واجعل تفرقنا من بعده تفرقا معصوما ولا تجعل فينا ولا منا شقيا ولا محروما اللهم ارحمنا بترك المعاصي ابدا ما احييتنا وارحمنا بترك ما لا يعنينا اللهم انصر الاسلام والمسلمين اللهم انصر الاسلام والمسلمين اللهم انصر الاسلام والمسلمين اللهم ارفع مقتك وغضبك عنا يا ارحم الراحمين يا حي يا قيوم برحمتك نستغيث يا حي يا قيوم برحمتك نستغيث يا حي يا قيوم برحمتك نستغيث واخر دعوانا الحمد لله عباد الله ان
الله أشهد أن محمد إلا الله